Evening, everyone. So lovely to be here with you. Tonight, there are two themes that I'd like to talk about. So the first, I'll be talking about dependent origination, dependent arising, paticca samuppada. So we'll have some continuity from Tuere's talk from last night. So I'll pick up where she left off. And then I'd like to spend some more time discussing the second foundation of mindfulness, Vedana. Considering there are four foundations of mindfulness, of body, Vedana, mind, and Dhammas, the Buddha made a whole foundation for Vedana. So it seems like it would make sense to linger here a bit, to spend a little bit more time with this topic. So here's a very short poem from a very large book called the Visuddhimagga, and it's a poem addressed to the Buddha. It goes like this. A tangle within, a tangle without, the whole world is entangled in a tangle. Tell me, Gotama, who can untangle this tangle? So I appreciate the term tangle because if yarn is tangled, it's usually in some sort of knot. It's really tight. And when I get entangled, I often tighten up around something as though a knot is tightening in me. And you may have felt this in yourself when you experienced dukkha. There's some sort of tightening or knot or contraction within you. So when I was a kid, I was about 7 years old. I went to the Grand Canyon with my parents. And if you're not from the United States, the Grand Canyon is one of the natural marvels of this country, one of the most beautiful places here. It's in Arizona. And interestingly enough, I don't actually remember the Grand Canyon so much, but what I do remember is a toy from the gift shop. I was totally mesmerized by this little metal toy that it was like two hooks or maybe like a loop and another loop, and they were joined to each other like this, and they looked like they could never be untangled or unhooked from each other. But somehow, if you jiggled them just the right way, or you shook them just right, or moved them in just the right pattern, they would unhook. And so I spent a lot of time playing with this toy. And when I was thinking about this, like my obsession with decoupling this little toy, it reminded me a little bit of how the mind works. So the mind picks up a troubling scenario, and it replays it about a million times, over and over and over, trying to find the loophole, trying to find the way out, trying to fix a certain situation, or find the perfect thing to say in a conversation, over and over. And the mind is so entangled in its own content that it doesn't realize that the entire Grand Canyon is before it, or the beauty of our life is right in front of us. So that toy is long gone, but I am still interested in how we get hooked. How do we get tangled, and how do we get unentangled? The Buddha referred to our mire in dukkha as entanglement. He said, if it were not possible to free the heart from entanglement in unhealthy states, I would not teach you to do so. But just because it is possible to free the heart from entanglement in unhealthy states, do I offer these teachings. So one of these teachings is dependent origination, also known as dependent arising. And this teaching, it can seem rather confusing or inaccessible, But put really simply, the 12-fold chain, dependent arising, is just a description of how we get caught in suffering. So you can just think of it that way. It's just a description of how we suffer. And though it's a description of how we get caught in suffering, it's through studying the links of the chain that we figure out how we can become free from suffering. And we can see that the chain can actually be broken. So put another way, by studying the links of the chain, we can find out how to become unhooked from our suffering. So Tuwery spoke about the first four links: ignorance, mental formations, consciousness, and name and form. I'll post, for people who like lists, I'll post a picture of the Wheel of Dependent Arising in the lobby, so you don't have to remember all of these. I'll be focusing on the next four links of the chain, and these links stand alone. So if you're still kind of confused about the first few links or feel like, it's still a little opaque, that's totally okay. This is an independent practice unto itself. And what I appreciate about these links is they're the easiest to see in daily practice. And of the four, we'll really zoom in on two of them. So ones I'm going to focus on are the six sense bases, contact, vedana, and craving. And now I'll go through them so you get to know them a little bit more. So the first that I'm going to be talking about, which is actually the fifth in the chain, is six senses, so pretty straightforward. Eye, ear, nose, mouth, body, mind. You know, a little different here in the West. We usually have five senses. Buddhism, we throw in a sixth, the mind. Okay, next link in the chain, contact. So contact happens when a sense door meets a sense object and consciousness. So these three things come together in a moment of contact. And when I say consciousness, I just mean like not asleep. So like if somebody was injured and a paramedic came to the scene, they might say, is the person conscious? Meaning like, are they awake and able to interact? It doesn't necessarily mean that the person's mindful. So just to distinguish, there can be consciousness, but mindfulness isn't necessarily present. So contact, sense door, object, consciousness come together. So for one who is conscious with working eyes, when the eyes see a sight object, that could be a person or a chair or a car or something shiny or smooth or textured or a color or shape, there's a moment of contact. Same with hearing. I hear a sound, that's a sound object. Hearing happens. So I think most of the sense doors make sense. It's pretty straightforward. With the body, it's what's felt, and that can be something felt with the hands, on the skin. It can also be a sensation inside the body. So that's all contact, bodily contact. And the one that some people get a little bit thrown by is the mind. So the mind door makes contact with a mind object. Well, what's a mind object? Thoughts, emotions. A mood could be a mind object. So contact in the mind is when one of those things is present, you know, when a thought occurs or an emotion occurs. Okay, so we've got six senses, contact. Now the third link in the chain I'm going to talk about is vedana. And it happens to be the seventh link, so I like to think of it as lucky number seven. So as you know, we have this spectrum of feeling tone. We might have very pleasant on one end, very unpleasant on the other end, but you know, something might be just kind of pleasant, maybe kind of unpleasant, or maybe neither, neutral, somewhere in between. And we can experience vedana at each of the six sense bases, right? So you know, every moment of seeing, there's vedana to that. And I kind of have fun exploring different ways to practice with vedana. So like I might notice when I'm sitting at the dining hall with a plate of food, like just like, especially because it can be so pleasant looking at a plate of food, like what's the most pleasant place on this plate of food? Like, oh, it's like the little sheen of moisture or oil on the cheese, like most pleasant point. And maybe like least pleasant point is like the little murky shadow under the kale or something like that, right? So just to like explore, experience, like what's pleasant, what's unpleasant, what's happening here? Every sound has Vedana. You might play around with, you're just sitting in the hall, and if you're practicing at the ear door, just listening to sounds coming and going, just noticing the ever-changing flow of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral as it comes and goes. And sometimes it'll be neutral for a really long time. Sometimes it'll be something pleasant, something unpleasant. So just seeing what occurs at that sense gate. Body sensations. It can be really interesting to explore how there can be a pleasant part of the body at the same time that another part of the body is feeling something extremely unpleasant. So, check that out, how I can resource, I can go somewhere pleasant, I can check out something unpleasant, just exploring the world of Vedana. And with the mind, mind contact includes emotion, so we can explore the Vedana of emotions. The Vedana of anger is typically unpleasant, unless it's self-righteous anger, in which case it might have a little bit of pleasant in it. Every thought has Vedana. And the feeling tone of thoughts, I think, are the most pernicious. Because it's the feeling tone of thoughts that dictates so much of our behavior. And I'll talk about that a little bit later on in the talk. So when we practice with Vedana, there are a lot of different ways that we can practice with it. We can just include it in our field of awareness, noticing when things have a strong feeling tone. If we're triggered by something, it can be interesting to tone into, what's the feeling tone right now? What's happening here? And particularly, just getting curious about it can be so helpful because it's such a critical link in the chain of dependent arising. And that's because it's the very next link after Vedana is craving. So it's that movement from Vedana to craving that describes the movement from ease to suffering. So that's why we really care about that link. That's why this is really important. So, if you recall, for this eighth link in the chain, the Four Noble Truths, craving, and the Buddha said, in this life, there's suffering. The source of suffering is tanha, thirst, or craving. So by placing this in the chain of dependent arising, we really get to see that shift taking place, that movement to craving. And I also want to note, in the 12-fold chain, craving, that term is being used to encapsulate craving, aversion, and delusion. So that the three defilements are all a part of craving. So it's kind of a grab bag, and you get all three. It might be manifesting in any given moment. You might just be feeling craving, or just aversion, or just delusion. But you can know when you see that in the 12-fold chain, craving includes the three. So as we've explored in past talks here, and as you've probably explored in your own experience, the knee-jerk reaction to Vedana is craving. The untrained mind, that's just what it does. So when we experience pleasant Vedana, we want more. That wanting more is craving. When we experience unpleasant, we want less. That's also craving, but in the form of aversion. When it's neutral, it's so uninteresting, we don't really pay attention, and we'd prefer to move into the romance films or horror movies that our mind is playing to us because that's more interesting. And so we're swept into delusion. So without any mental training, one naturally goes through that, Vedana to craving. But even for those of us that have some training, there's so much karmic conditioning that causes this to happen, that causes craving to arise. So those are the four links that I wanted to focus on. Six senses. Then there's contact at a sense door, which conditions Vedana, which can lead to craving. And maybe I'll just say a little bit about the next link, which is clinging, but I won't spend much time there because Tuere will pick up in a future talk talking about the end of the chain of dependent arising. So this last one, clinging or grasping, upadana, it's the grabbing a hold of something. The craving is kind of like the reaching out, the wanting it to be different, and then the clinging's the fixation. So it's kind of like if you picture a little baby, like a cranky baby, reaching out, craving's happening, they're trying to find something to make them feel better, and then they see mom clinging, grabbing a hold, right? So that's that movement, craving to clinging. So this process of moving through these links of the chain, it usually happens really fast. Usually we don't catch it happening. And I noticed how quickly this process happens a few years ago when I was eating some nut butter. I don't know if it was peanut butter or tahini, something like that. And what you should know is I really like nut butter. And so I'm sitting there, I'm having my snack, I'm eating it out of the jar, loving my snack, finish, go to the refrigerator, open the door, move some things aside, put my jar. And then I notice there's something kind of strange about the way that I put the jar in the fridge. And I notice then, okay, so there's, and it was pleasant. First there was the sense gate, mouth, six senses, mouth. Makes contact with peanut butter. It's pleasant. There was craving for more. And then clinging happened. And what I realized is I wasn't just setting it in the fridge. I was hiding it in the fridge. I was hiding it so my husband wouldn't find it and eat it without me. So the mind is sneaky. We don't usually see these things, but when we do, like, how cool to see that. Like, how wonderful to get to see the things the mind is doing. So you may notice these sorts of things playing out in your own life in smaller or greater degrees while here on retreat. It might happen in the dining room where you have mouth contact with something, it's pleasant, some craving arises for more, maybe you that manifests as glancing up at the buffet table to see if there's, you know, more stewed fruit in the container or whatever it is that you have your eye on, or maybe an impulse to go write down the recipe so that you can, you know, keep it, save it for later. Or maybe you notice this, the links of the chain happening in the meditation hall. Maybe it's mid-morning. I've been sitting for a few hours, and I notice sloth and torpor arise in the mind. So there's the mind door, that's six in the six senses category. There's contact, mind door meets sloth and torpor. So mind contact occurs. It's typically unpleasant for me. And then maybe some aversion arises in that. You know, so I move from Vedana to craving. Oh, I want to get rid of this sloth and torpor. And so I might be trying different things, frustrated, I stand up, I bite my lip, I squint my eyes, like, well, that's going to work. And so that's already a suffering state, right? But then every moment there's a chance to go back through the wheel of suffering. And so I might, I'm trying to figure out how to get rid of this sloth and torpor. I might go through my little mental Rolodex of, like, how can I fix this? Like, what can I do to make this better? And so maybe I land on a thought. So another moment of mind contact, and this one has pleasant Vedana because it's the thought of a cup of tea. Radiant, beautiful, excellent. This will make me happy. This will fix this problem. And so then there's the grasping, and the clinging as I go, oh, I need this cup of tea to feel better. So then I spend the rest of the sit going, gosh, you know, is it time to get my tea yet? Is this done yet? When are they going to ring the bell? Did they forget to ring the bell? I really need my tea. I'm really tired. So we can just see the way that in each moment, we can find ourselves in a moment of craving again and again and again. So Ajahn Chah talks about this like this process of grasping pleasure or, grasping pleasant things and grasping unpleasant things as a little bit like grabbing a poisonous snake. So if you grab the head, it will immediately bite you. That's like grabbing something that's unpleasant, grabbing pain. If you grab pleasure, this is like grabbing the tail of the snake because it's fine at first, but then it swings it around and bites you when the pleasantness fades away because we know everything's impermanent. Even if we have something pleasant, that's going to go. So either way, if there's craving present and we grab hold, we're going to get bitten. So what's our alternative? How do we break the chain? I want to read you a little bit of the Bahiya Sutta, which is from the Udana in the Kutika Nikaya 1.1. So Bahiya was a deeply venerated teacher, and he was so venerated that he got to thinking, pretty good at this teaching thing, and I'm probably enlightened. Until a deva came and visited him, and the deva was like, hey, Bahiya, I hate to break it to you, but actually, you're not enlightened. And fortunately, Bahiya was humble enough to go seek out help from the Buddha. So he goes and he walks across the country in a single night or something like that and gets to the Buddha and asks for advice. And the Buddha's kind of busy. He's like, Bahiya, I'm going on alms. I've got a lot going on. This isn't really a good time. But Bahiya asks a few times. And so finally the Buddha's like, okay, I'll teach you the Dhamma in brief. And I love it when the Buddha teaches the Dhamma in brief. It seems so Western, like, let's get to the point here. Like, give me the Dhamma in a nutshell. So here's what he says to Bahiya. He says, Bahiya, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you, there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then Bahiya, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress. So this passage to Bahiya, it points to just resting in contact, just contact at the sense doors, just resting in Vedana. Whatever's occurring, just the seen in the seen, just the heard in the heard, really simple. When there's a feeling tone, you don't need to go beyond that. You don't need to take the leap from the seventh link of the chain, Vedana, to the eighth, craving. So when I was in my 20s, I woke up one morning with a really bad stomach ache. And I was having a really hard time digesting just about anything. I'd have a few tablespoons of food, and then it would take me about 4 or 5 hours of painfully trying to digest that, and then I'd have another few tablespoons of food, and then it would be another many hours of trying to work through that, and then I'd try again. So little by little, trying to eat a bit. And this this condition kept hoping it would go away, but it lasted for about 8 years. And it went in and out of that, but it was mostly in. And it was such a challenging time because I became very malnourished in different bodily processes were stopping functioning. And I received this kind of onslaught of diagnoses. And it was a time where in my practice, there was a very common track that played. And it was called the woe is me track. The self-pity track was strong during that time. But fortunately, I had already encountered the Dhamma. And so even though some of my regular life refuges weren't available to me anymore, I couldn't take refuge in food the way I used to be able to, or in going out for a recreational walk, or in riding a bike, or backpacking, or doing some of the normal things that I loved to do, I was able to turn and take refuge in the Dhamma. And so around that time, I started sitting long retreats at Spirit Rock. And I around then, I moved to Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, which is a secluded Zen monastery in the Ventana Wilderness. So when I moved there, fortunately, I was well enough to do the practice. But I could keep up with things. And the especially in the fall and the winter and the spring, it's the monastic season where there's a lot more sitting. So we'd wake up in the morning at about 3:45, go to the Zendo, sit meditation till about noon, do a little work, go back to the Zendo. So lots of sitting. And during those years, I had a lot of time to sit with physical pain. And there was one particular day where I took a few sips of, I think it was ginger tea or water or something very benign. And I had it at the wrong time, and it set my body off in one of these multi-hour spells of pain, of digestive pain. And this particular day actually provided a very fruitful opportunity to see the links of dependent arising in action. So when I was sitting that day, there was a lot of unpleasant vedana. You know, there was sense contact, bodily contact with sensations in my abdomen. They were unpleasant. There was tightening and gripping and pressure, tingling, all sorts of things happening in this area of my body. However, the mind was pretty relaxed around it. The mind wasn't agitated, so it was just able to kind of hang out with the sensations. And then a few hours into the sitting, I watched this thought percolate up from the depths, who knows where. And it said something like, I can't believe this pain is still happening from a few sips of tea. And it wasn't the content of the thought that was so important, but it was this sort of contempt for my experience. And the feeling of the thought was, this shouldn't be happening. It shouldn't be like this. And it was in that moment that the dukkha erupted in my mind. It cut just like a knife in my experience. And this was such an important moment in my practice because it showed me where the suffering was. The suffering wasn't in the sense object, that wasn't the dukkha. It wasn't the stomach pain. It wasn't the unpleasantness of the stomach pain. It was the craving that caused the dukkha. It was so clear because it went from a moment of ease to a moment of intense suffering. You know, in this moment, the craving was so obvious. There's a very classic sutta called the Dart, SN 36.6, sometimes referred to as the arrow or referred to sometimes as the second arrow. And I'd say it's one of the most commonly taught suttas. And I had heard about it for a really long time, but it wasn't until more recently that I realized, oh, this is a sutta that's actually about Vedana. This is actually pointing directly to Vedana. And in it, they're comparing an untaught worldling, a non-practitioner, with a noble disciple, a practitioner. So in it, it says, you know, an untaught worldling experiences pleasant, unpleasant, and neither, or we could say neutral, and a noble disciple experiences pleasant, unpleasant, and neither. So what's the difference? And the Buddha said, when an untaught worldling is touched by painful Vedana, he worries and grieves. He laments, beats his breast, weeps, and is distraught. He thus experiences two kinds of Vedana, a bodily and a mental Vedana. It is as if a man were pierced by a dart, and following the first piercing, he is hit by a second dart. So that person will experience Vedana caused by two darts. Having been touched by that painful feeling, he resists and resents it. Then in him who so resists and resents that painful feeling, an underlying tendency of resistance against that painful feeling comes to underlie the mind. So when I was sitting in the meditation hall that day and the thought arose, this shouldn't be this way, I want this to be otherwise, I shot myself with a second dart. And if you've noticed in your own practice that you've shot a second dart, there's no reason to lament or to judge yourself for that. Because if you do notice that you've shot a second dart or second arrow and judge and lament, then you're just shooting a third dart. So with this practice, you can just stop wherever you are and just notice what's happening. No need to shoot a third dart. Sometimes I find myself on the 50th dart. Wherever you are, you can stop and go, oh, what's happening right now? Oh, it's like this now. One of the aspects of Zen training is to learn to be a ceremonial instrumentalist. So that role is called a doan, D-O-A-N. And the Zen ceremonies have lots of instruments. There's bells, and there's wooden blocks that you play, and there's an instrument that's shaped like a wooden carved fish, a lacquered fish, all sorts of different instruments. And sometimes the instrumental parts are actually pretty complex. And it's a somewhat vulnerable job to have because not all monks have a background in music. So it's often people who are, you know, pretty new to instruments getting up there and playing these, you know, complex musical parts. And it's a very public role because everyone in the community can hear if you hit the bell at the wrong time. So a number of years ago, one of the doans, the ceremonial instrumentalists, was sitting at the set of bells playing for a ceremony. And the ceremony was being officiated by our former abbess at San Francisco Zen Center, Blanche Hartman. So the ceremony's going along just fine. It gets to this certain point, and the doan hits the bell, and it's the wrong moment. And the whole community notices that bell was hit at the wrong time. Blanche looks over at the instrumentalist, and the doan winces, makes that kind of universal facial expression of like, ah, shoot. And then the ceremony goes on. But after the ceremony, the doan went up to Blanche and said, Blanche, I want to apologize for hitting the bell at the wrong time. And Blanche looked at the person and she said, the mistakes on the bell are inevitable, but the face was extra. So that's the second dart, right? That's the second arrow. And often it lands before we even know it's been shot. You know, it's that, you know, there's a certain feeling tone in the body. Maybe it's unpleasant. We respond with some reactivity and, you know, as a knee-jerk response, just like a wince. You know, there's a wince in the mind or a little frustration or, I wish it wasn't so. And so what's extra? We can look in our practice, what's extra here? And our job is just to notice, is there anything extra in how I'm relating to my experience? So here's a practice to help you notice when you've moved from Vedana into craving. And this is something you can add into whatever practice you're already doing. Maybe you're with the breath, or you're listening to sounds, or practicing with open awareness. And the practice is quite simple. It's just to check your relationship to what's happening. So this is an Utejaniya practice called checking the attitude. It's just checking, is there greed present? Is there aversion present? Or is there delusion present in this moment? And the way to do this, to check for greed, we might just ask ourselves, am I wanting something to happen? To check for aversion. Am I wanting to make something stop happening? For delusion. Am I not in touch with what's happening? So this allows us to see where we are in the 12-fold chain, to see if we're just resting in the six senses, noticing Vedana coming and going, or if we've slipped past Vedana and we're in the dukkha realm, you know, if we've slipped into craving and clinging. And as you get more familiar with this practice, you might not have to ask yourself anymore, am I wanting to make something happen right now? Am I wanting to make something stop happening right now? Am I not in touch with what's happening right now? You might not have to ask all of those. You might just ask, how am I relating to my experience? How am I relating to my experience? And that way you can incorporate it into your practice, maybe just by asking that, checking in with that three or four times during a sitting, just to see, is there any underlying craving in the mind? Sometimes it's subtle and we don't notice it's there until we look for it. So you ask this question, what then? Well, sometimes you look and craving won't be present. In that case, just keep practicing. Congratulations, you are free of suffering in that moment. Sometimes you'll ask those questions and you'll see that craving, aversion, or delusion are present. In which case we want to meet that, we want to meet the craving with spaciousness and acceptance. So no big deal if we notice that craving is present. We might even be grateful to see it. You know, it might be like, oh, check it out, hiding peanut butter in the refrigerator. Whoa, I never would have seen that. So it can almost be a little celebration to see what was previously missing or what was previously unseen there. Because remember, if you meet it with, oh no, I'm striving for, if you meet the thought, oh no, I'm striving for a concentration state again, you're shooting an additional arrow. So when you notice craving, sometimes just seeing, oh, craving's happening is enough to have it fall away. Or, oh, aversion's present. And that just that clear seeing will have it release. Sometimes the craving or aversion has a lot of energy to it and it doesn't just fall away. And when that's the case, you might try just turning to look at the the craving, to look at the craving or the aversion that's present. You can make that the new object of meditation. So in my example, where I saw the dukkha in my mind so clearly of this stomach pain shouldn't be this way, and seeing that the stomach pain wasn't the dukkha, but the aversion was the dukkha, when I saw the aversion, I just turned and experienced fully the aversion. I experienced the aversion fully in the body. So as Ajahn Sumedho would say, it's like this now. It's like this. Aversion is like this. And by turning towards the craving or the aversion, feeling it fully and feeling it fully, really getting to know it, the mind learns that the habit of craving is suffering. This is a suffering state. This act of patiently watching the mind's craving and aversion over and over and feeling the dukkha of it, feeling how unpleasant that craving state is, it begins to release the pattern. Eventually, the mind heart begins to learn, oh, this doing this is not a path to happiness. But so rather than projecting our problems out to external objects, we're turning inwards and going, oh, the dukkha is right here. And I can release this dukkha. And releasing the dukkha doesn't come from trying to get rid of it. It comes from seeing it and knowing it clearly and fully. I've watched this pattern in myself so many times of the pain, of feeling pain, or feeling anxiety about the pain, or feeling self-pity about the pain, and then noticing the aversion, and then getting to know the aversion, that my system has started to become disenchanted with that flavor of dukkha. It's like my on my better days, my mind just doesn't want to pick it up anymore. It knows. It's like grabbing a hot coal. Like, oh, this burns. Like, we don't need to do this anymore. And it's really wonderful to get to sit and rest in the Vedana. And particularly if something's unpleasant, if you can sit with something that's unpleasant, say in the body, or anything that's unpleasant, it doesn't have to be a physical sensation, it could be a sound or anything else, and to do that without reactivity, it plants such wholesome seeds. It's transforming so much karma to be able to rest in that moment. And so for me, if I'm having body pain and I can just sit there with the pain without reaction, without aversion, I sometimes get this little twinkle of joy in the heart, knowing, wow, this is so powerful to break the chain here. Now, this is a moment of breaking the chain, of not reacting unskillfully to unpleasant Vedana. So in your own practice, when you notice something challenging, can you meet it with openness, with relaxation, with curiosity, and make room for it? And really, it's okay to feel the unpleasantness of aversion or to feel the unpleasantness of the grasping, because you're training your system, oh, this doesn't feel good. We don't need to do this anymore. I want to say just a little more about how wholesome it is to rest in the experience of sense contact and Vedana, and doing that without reactivity. And the reason I want to do that is because it's like a little taste of freedom, like freedom underlined. One of the simplest definitions of freedom, or enlightenment or nibbana, is the complete uprooting of greed, hatred, and delusion. So that's a really simple definition of nibbana. The liberated mind is free from greed, aversion, and delusion. So by resting in the simplicity of the sense contact, in feeling the Vedana, it's like a foretaste of freedom. Guy Armstrong says, nibbana, the freedom that the Buddha pointed to, is in this place where there is no becoming, where there is no birth or death, when we rest in that gap being between Vedana and craving, we are in that state temporarily. It's not the final liberation, but you could say it's like a little foretaste of the peace of Nibbana. Ajahn Buddhadasa has a very well-known teaching called Nibbana for Everyone, where he talks about this as well. He talks about how when the mind is free from defilements, he calls it a temporary Nibbana. It's just a little taste. And if it wasn't for these little tastes, we'd probably all go mad. If we had the defilements all day long, every day, without some gaps, I think the word he used is we would be roasted by the defilements, burned alive by the defilements. So while in retreat, one can get so fixated on the final goal of practice, striving for some far-off liberation, sometimes we forget to appreciate these little foretastes of freedom. I was thinking about this short story where a student and their teacher are walking by a river, and the teacher's on one side of the river, and the student's on the other side of the river, and the student yells out, "Master, how do I get to the other shore?" And the master replies, "You are on the other shore." And it can be helpful to remember sometimes, oh, this moment right now, no matter how unpleasant it is, can be a moment that's free from greed, hatred, and delusion. This is a foretaste of Nibbana. Ah, like some satisfaction, some contentment there. Whatever arises, just opening to that possibility. Through this process of noticing our relentless reactions to Vedana, a mature relationship to Vedana can occur. And because so much of this process that I'm talking about depends on how we relate to Vedana, I want to spend a little more time now discussing what I like to call the three C's of Vedana. So this describes a mature relationship to Vedana. And my hope is that by sharing it, it inspires you to get to know Vedana a little bit more fully. So here are the three C's of Vedana. Vedana can't be controlled. Vedana is not constant. And Vedana cannot lead to reliable contentment. Can't be controlled, not constant, can't lead to reliable contentment. And so Temple talked about some of these, but we're just looking at Vedana from just some different angles, different ways in to the same teachings. So to start, we can't control Vedana. We tend to design our lives around Vedana. So usually the insight that we can't control Vedana hasn't really penetrated. There's still some sense in me that I can control Vedana. It's really, really a seductive thing. So in Western culture, there can be a sort of unspoken belief that underlies our life, which is this belief that to create a happy life, we need to string together as many moments of pleasant Vedana as possible. Like, that's what a happy life is. And if an unpleasant moment gets in there, we're doing something wrong or this isn't okay. And then we try to control Vedana by getting or rejecting objects or experiences that we imbue with certain feeling tones. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So we experience something pleasant, try to get that to happen again. Say that the thing that we want to have happen again is a hike. Maybe we go out on a great hike. It's sunset, our heart is filled with joy. Oh my gosh, I want to go on hikes all the time. This is the best thing ever. So we have, in that moment, we have the actual hike, and then we have the idea of the hike. And that idea now is associated with a pleasant feeling tone. Now it's a thought. But of course, the idea of the hike is not the hike. So we might spend the rest of our life trying to recreate pleasant feeling tone by going on hikes. But the feeling tone's always changing. It may or may not work. And the next hike is always going to be different than the last. So the thinking mind really tries to control Vedana in a huge way. And this is one of the reasons it can be so fruitful to be able to start seeing the Vedana associated with thoughts and mental formations. So Munindra, great teacher Munindra, used to say, the thought of your mother is not your mother. And when I'm fixated on a mental object, I sometimes bring this to mind. And I have a little phrase that I use when I'm thinking of something that has a strong Vedana associated with it, and I'm caught. And the phrase is, the thought is not the thing. The thought is not the thing. So we try to control Vedana by organizing our life around ideas, thoughts of what's pleasant and unpleasant, but the thought is not the thing. We can't control Vedana. Okay, so that's the first one. Second one, Vedana is not constant. There's a ceremony in the Zen world called Shosan, S-H-O-S-A-N. And in the ceremony, one of the senior Zen teachers will sit in a big chair in front of the assembly, and each person in the assembly will have a chance to ask a question. And the request is to that the question come from the heart of one's practice, and it be expressed in one breath, so meaning a short question. So some time ago, a Shosan ceremony was happening, and it got to one of the students, and the student said, Roshi, how do I keep the heart open? And the Roshi replied by raising a fist in the air. And the Roshi said, is this a heart? And the person was like, no. And the Roshi then opened their hand and they said, is this a heart? And meanwhile, people are kind of confused. And then the Roshi starts doing this. How about this? Is this a heart? Pulsing the hand. Yeah, wait a second. That actually looks a little bit more like a heart now. Open, close. Open, close. This is the natural movement of the heart. It doesn't always stay open. We can't keep the heart open. How do we keep the heart open always? We don't. The heart closes. That's actually how it functions. That's how it pumps blood through our life. Open, close. Pleasant, unpleasant. Pleasant, unpleasant. Pleasant, unpleasant. Vedana is impermanent. It is not constant. So the third, Vedana can't lead to reliable contentment. Seems pretty straightforward if you know the first two, right? If you know that you can't control Vedana and that it's not constant, that it's impermanent, well, it can't really be a reliable source of happiness then, right? We think if we get the pleasant thing, then we'll be happy. But we already know that Vedana can't be controlled. It's inconstant. This is not a reliable refuge. So we have this belief that our liberation depends on pleasant states. But that's not true, right? So this mature relationship to Vedana provides so much freedom. It's so important to remember that your freedom on this retreat actually doesn't have to do with how pleasant or unpleasant your meditation is. even after awakening, the Buddha experienced pleasant states and unpleasant states, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant states. But rather than reacting with craving, with aversion, with delusion, he just experienced them as they came. In the hearing, just the heard. In the seeing, just the seen. In the cognized, just the cognized. Really simple. So wherever you find yourself, you can stop shooting arrows. You can stop shooting darts. Just meet yourself wherever you are. How am I relating to this? And if there's craving in that moment, oh, craving is like this. No big deal. And in doing so, we can learn to rest in Vedana. We can learn to rest in the feeling tone of what's happening. And to do that is to learn to love our life. So I'd like to close with a poem. It's called In This Passing Moment by Hogan Bays, co-abbot of Great Vow Monastery. And I'll just read a piece of it for you. In this passing moment, karma ripens, and all things come to be. I vow to choose what is. If there's cost, I choose to pay. If there is need, I choose to give. If there is pain, I choose to feel. If there is sorrow, I choose to grieve. When burning, I choose heat. When calm, I choose peace. When starving, I choose hunger. When happy, I choose joy. Whom I encounter, I choose to meet. What I shoulder, I choose to bear. When it is my death, I choose to die. Where this takes me, I choose to go. Being with what is, I respond to what is. So let's sit for a few moments together. If there is pain, I choose to feel. If there is sorrow, I choose to grieve. When burning, I choose heat. When calm, I choose peace. Thank you very much for your kind attention this evening. We'll have our period of walking now and then chanting this evening afterwards. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.